Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And it's just the two of us today. We're flying solo, but we have a topic that's fairly timely, and we wanted to get it out to y'all because it is currently in commentary period with the Texas Supreme Court. We wanted to cover kind of the substance and give some of our thoughts and make sure that people have plenty of time to give their thoughts to the Supreme Court Rules Committee on this. And that is the new summary judgment rule that the Texas Supreme Court promulgated right at the end of 2025.
Yeah, that's right, Jody. This is hot off the press. December 30th of 25 is when the court issued miscellaneous docket number 25-9106. Some folks who've been paying attention know generally about the statutory changes that came about in the last regular and one of the special sessions. I'll just mention those statutes real quick. SB 293 was enacted on June 2nd, 2025, and the HB 16 was enacted in August of 25, although the court's order says August 26th of 26. Even the court gets to make a typo from time to time.
I can't fault them. I'm still writing 25 and we're into 26 already, so.
I will be into March probably, but.
Same.
But to get us back on track, yeah, we kind of knew this was coming because the legislature said, Supreme Court, we want you to have rules in place by March 1st of 2026. And so while everybody was enjoying their time off for between the Christmas and New Year's at the holiday time, Supreme Court issued this new miscellaneous docket order, which is we've come to know and love these more than ever before, I think, in recent times. And we'll get into the nitty gritty of the statutes here in just a second. But with this rule revision, the court is calling for comments to be submitted in writing at the email address listed in the order by February 28th. So we have a little time, but based on how it went with the last set of orders, I think the newest rules of appellate procedure were actually approved and adopted before the last day of the comment period even expired. So
sooner may be better on this.
Be sure and get your comments in. Yeah, sooner is better. And we're going to talk about some potential changes that you and I have noted individually. But the interesting thing about this rule, and then we'll go back in time like we like to do, talk about the statute and practice under Rule 166A. Up to now. But the interesting thing about this rule, it contrasts with some other recent rule changes that the Supreme Court has brought about, is that it is a complete rewrite. They didn't even put out a red line. And so we'll get into the details there. I suppose we could give even a little bit of history, kind of set the stage, talk about the last time there was a major rewrite of Rule 166, which was at the same time that the rules of appellate procedure were adopted in September of 1997. And that was when the Supreme Court, for the first time, adopted what will soon be former Rule 166AI, the no evidence summary judgment rule. And that was a big deal at the time. I won't bore everyone with how long I've been licensed and all the experience I've had over the years and watching these rules rewrites. I did that with the petition for review process and new rules there. But this was all happening around the same time. If you listen to that episode, September 1 of 97, the court adopted for the first time a no evidence summary judgment rule, which again, as we've talked about before, was intended to bring our rules, you know, more in line with what the federal courts do and put some structure on how to go about challenging an opposing party's case, a claim or defense on no evidence grounds. And that has, over the last almost 30 years, become ingrained in our practice. And in doing some digging around for preparing for today's episode, I was reminded, I'd forgotten about this, that change, you know, adopting no evidence motions wasn't without some controversy. And even the order adopting it, there were a couple of dissents among the justices at the time for a couple of different reasons. But all that's now water under the bridge. We've got complete rewrite of the rule. And so, Jody, why don't you kind of take us through the high points of the statute, maybe what the court's motivation was. Well, it's not the court, I guess, that really is motivated. It's the ledge. And that's what we have to remember here is this new rule comes about because of these statutes. And the legislature, you know, has the power and authority when it enacts statutes to tell the Supreme Court, hey, we need you to adopt some rules that implement this. And we've seen that over and over again on procedural issues that the legislature has gotten involved in. But let me kick it over to you and let you kind of set the stage further on what we're going to talk about when we get into the details of the rule.
Sure. So it started this summer in the regular session of the legislature with SB 293. And SB 293 was an act that had to do with the discipline of judges, judicial compensation, reporting of transparency, and all of that, which doesn't seem like a place where you would put a new summary judgment rule. But I think it kind of fits into the overall view of the legislature, which seems to be that judges need more accountability and transparency. And so this is where you find it right up at the very beginning. They created a new procedural statute that at the time in that bill said that a court had to hear oral argument or on submission a summary judgment motion 45 days after the response was filed, which is not the rule, as you'll hear. And then it had to be done and ruled upon 90 days after the argument. And then it went through and said that the court had to make some docket entries and the OCA had to prepare some reports, all in the service of this idea of sort of judicial transparency and accountability. And I'm not going to go all the way through that statute, but another thing that I thought was interesting when looking through there that kind of reinforces this is if you look at amendments to the government code relating to the Judicial Conduct Commission, one of the things that now subjects these judges to discipline is willful, persistent, and unjustifiable failure to timely execute the business of the court, which includes failure to meet deadlines, performance measures or standards, or clearance rate requirements set by statute, administrative rule, or binding court order, which I think includes these new summary judgment orders and statistics. So it's pretty clear that the court thought that summary judgments were either sitting around too long without being heard or without being ruled upon and went about to do something. And if you go further down in the statute, they've added some requirements about written reports, compiling information, where district judges actually have to report how much time they're spending in court, what they're presiding over, the judicial duties, all that kind of stuff. Those are going to get circulated to the legislature and members of the executive branch of government. That is the background for all of this. So that got passed. Then in the second session, HB number 16 actually amended the new amendments to the rule even a little bit further and kind of changed some of the deadlines. And we'll go through in more detail, but it changed the setting and the hearing requirements keyed off of when the motion was filed, not the response, and gave the court a little bit of discretion in their ability to set it later out, but no later than 90 days. So that's where we got, and that was what the Supreme Court took to the Rules Committee to come up with the new summary judgment rule that we're going to go through in more detail. So it's just in the overall view of judicial accountability and transparency.
Right. I want to be sure, if we haven't, that we mention or we identify the statute. It's Texas Government Code Section 23.303. And that is, as it is currently, the statute that's informing what the Supreme Court has done, as Jody just indicated. And before we get out of the gate, I wanted to mention a few resources on this we've looked at and that have informed some of our thinking on where we're coming from, aside from, you know, both of us being having, you know, decades in practice and having handled a lot of summary judgments over the course of our career and being intimately familiar with the way the process has worked over the last, well, for me, you know, since the original rule was enacted, and Jody, a couple of decades for you now too. So we'll link to these in the show notes, but very recently, the litigation section of the State Bar of Texas put out in its very fine publication, The Advocate, an article by Gianna Ortiz and Jacob Fain. It's titled SB 293 and HB 16, A Faster Track for Summary Judgments. There's some good points and observations made in that piece, and it talks about some things that the Supreme Court might do when it enacts a rule, knowing that the rule was coming, but the rule had not yet been announced when this article came out. And so it's got some good background to kind of supplement Jody's point. And I think it does suggest that, again, somebody in the legislature decided that there needed to be stricter accountability on the part of our trial judges in Texas. And that, you know, not only includes very broad sort of reporting or timekeeping requirements that have not been imposed up to now on our trial judges, but also specifically getting the summary judgments ruled on. Because one thing that was a feature, maybe it was a bug, not a feature of the old system, was that there really wasn't a deadline. You know, the court never had a deadline to actually rule on an MSJ. that was one of the rare instances, Jody, in which you would hear about a trial judge getting mandamus on a summary judgment ruling. It was simply by failing to rule. Now, I've always questioned the wisdom of, what do you think your ruling's going to be if the judge is mandamus to rule? So it's, you know, you have to be, it's a delicate matter, shall we say. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that litigants expect, they go to the trouble to prepare an MSJ, that it's going to get ruled on. And whatever the reason, you know, some trial judges weren't doing it timely. Litigants didn't always have a good reason to set the motion, which was what drove all the deadlines under the old way. So with that, well, the other thing I was going to mention in terms of other resources is Jerry Buller did a paper and presented to the appellate section a few months ago. Steve Hayes moderated that talk, and Jody, you were involved in putting that together, I believe. I think that Judge Bullard's presentation is posted and available on the State Bar Appellate Section's website. And there was a really interesting discussion. A lot of questions came about because there was that weird interim period where there was a statute that had been enacted and was effective that imposed one set of deadlines. And at the time, we were still in that window where the other statute, I think, hadn't become effective, the amended version. So there was some real question about, okay, which version applies? What are the deadlines? We didn't have a rule. All that, I think, is mostly behind us now. Any MSJ filed now is going to be the rule that the Supreme Court is considering is going to be the applicable rule, and it's going to be the process as it was amended in the special session.
Tentatively starting March 1st, based on administrative order.
Correct. So we've got a little bit of lag, a few months lag. And I don't know about you, I just argued an MSJ today, just this morning. And my experience in talking to trial judges about this stuff is that they are very aware of those deadlines. They know what's being imposed on them. And we even had a little chuckle because the case I was in court on today was one that was not filed before the December 13th, I think, deadline. And so it's handled in that interim period. And the court said, don't worry, I'm not going to take 90 days to rule.
Well, that's good.
He was very astute and in tune with what the statute requires. So, and talking to other judges too, I don't know if this has been your experience, they are well aware of this. And I think, but it's interesting because I think it doesn't get as much discussion among practitioners. I know, you know, there are a lot of folks that do know about it. Folks like Judge Bullard in the appellate section and now the litigation section have done a good job of putting the information out there. But I think now that the Supreme Court has put out its proposed order, it's time to, for everybody to kind of get in line because, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to record this episode is because we have the vehicle to get together and talk about this, and we don't purport to know everything there is to know about it at this point. But it's helpful to, I think, to kind of start the conversation. And so with all of that sort of prefatory stuff, why don't we get into the meat and potatoes of the rule? We'll talk briefly maybe about the definitions.
I actually do want to talk about this, so go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to kind of, I think, flip back and forth on who takes the lead on different topics. But because it's a brand new rule, it's not redlined, as I said, I think this could be considered dry in other circles, but I think it's actually beneficial for us to go through it point by point and talk about it and talk about any changes from the old rule, even though it's not redlined, and how it's going to affect practice. So why don't I just kind of kick us off on the definitions? I won't read it, but basically the court provides in subsection A, it defines what a traditional summary judgment motion is, and it defines what a no evidence summary judgment motion is. And I think a lot of the language you'll notice from the new rule overall is familiar. It comes largely from either the text of the old rule, and that specifically would be referring to 166AC, which was the old traditional summary judgment motion rule, and AI, which was the no evidence rule enacted in 97. In the old rule 166AC, there really wasn't a label of calling it a traditional motion within the rule. But that is what it came to be known as because of the later amendment to adopt the no evidence component of the summary judgment rule. And then later in 166AI, it actually was referred to as a no evidence motion. So they're essentially just echoing concepts that we see either within the previous rule or in the case law where a traditional motion is one that claims there's no genuine issue as to any material fact of a claim or defense on which the movement would bear the burden of proof at trial.
I want to talk about that because I'm curious if you read this the same way I do, but I read that or could read. I think there's some ambiguity here. I read that to say, if you are the movement on summary judgment, potentially you may only move on claims or defenses that you have the burden of proof at trial. I don't think that's what they intended, but I think that is a plausible reading of this statute, is that you can't move on, and maybe you isolate claim from that requirement of burden of proof at trial, but even for defense, does that mean I can no longer move on my opponent's affirmative defenses? That doesn't seem like that could be what they intended, but I think that's a plausible reading of this rule.
I agree that I don't think that's what was intended. And so load up your email program and tell the Supreme Court that did you really mean to remove my ability to move for summary judgment affirmative defenses on traditional grounds? And so I think that's a great observation. And maybe this is a byproduct of the fact that this is the first time in a rule that the Supreme Court has actually defined what a traditional motion is. I think that's right, that this is something that maybe ought to be considered and examined further, because they've given us a hot opinion right out of the gate, Jody, and I think it's a good one. On the no evidence definition, it is literally what you've read in the case law a million times, and also in 166AI, just defining what a no evidence motion is one, claiming that there's no evidence of one or more essential elements of a claim or defense in that instance, on which the other party, the adverse party, has the burden of proof at trial. I think anybody who's ever filed a summary judgment motion in Texas understands that, knows what that means. I don't think that's controversial, and I think that's pretty much carried forward from the law as it existed. To that point about substantive changes, we do have in the comment to the 2026 change, at the very end of the order, and the court does say that other than the deadline changes, which we'll get into, that the rewrite is not intended to substantively change the law. There's your fodder for your email to the rules attorney, because I think pointed out is, you know, potentially a change in the law that was not intended.
No, I think that's right.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today.
That's it for the definitions. The next subsection is about the motion itself, and so I'll just kind of run through that. Part one is you can combine both traditional and no evidence motions. That's not really anything new. You have to title it one of three things, which is interesting. This is new, but more specific. Either a traditional motion for summary judgment, a no evidence motion for summary judgment, or combined motion for summary judgment. That's more specific than it was. I'm not sure substantively it makes any difference, but it says an absent or incorrect title won't get you out of the motion. You can't use that as grounds to deny, which ought to be the way.
Kind of sad that they even have to say that.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, there's appellate lawyers like us that are just going to make something out of it. One big change procedurally in here is if you want an oral hearing and you're the movement, you have to put your request on the cover of the motion. And it's the same for us with appellate briefs, but that's something that you've never had to have before. And so I think practitioners need to make a note of that, because you need to just start whatever form or draft or paralegal or anybody you use, just make sure they know in bold oral hearing requested needs to go right up there.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. But before we move on from the titles, do you find it interesting the court's telling us how to title our motions?
I do too. That is oddly specific.
It is oddly specific. I also find it interesting, and I think probably unnecessary, frankly, but I also find it interesting that they chose the title combined motion instead of hybrid, which is what we see all over the case law. These rules contemplate as a combined motion for summary judgment, which I think is correct, typically referred to as a hybrid motion. And a lot of the cases talk about hybrid motions, the strategy of, well, you know, if you've got a what's now going to be called a combined motion, which grounds do you pick up first when you're analyzing this from the court's perspective? Probably doesn't change the law substantively, as it clearly didn't intend to do that, but I'll just say it's a point of interest. And then on the cover, I made that note too about the, I guess one thing that we need to ask ourselves is, I mean, how often do you use a quote unquote cover in your MSJs or responses? You know, maybe it's more, you put it as a, not really a subtitle or a subcaption, but there's ways to do it on the first page of your motion without actually having to use a cover like we do.
Which is my guess is what they mean is the first page rather than cover.
Right. Agreed.
And as far as the titles go, I just wonder if maybe that's more of a notice thing so that somebody can't later claim, oh, well, I definitely meant to, this is actually traditional and not just no evidence, or this really was meant to be no evidence. I guess you have to just make it clear kind of up front. This is either traditional no evidence or it's both. And you can't kind of come back later and say, oh, well, it was a motion for summary judgment. But what I meant was, that's the only thing I could think of as for that. It goes on to say, for a traditional motion, you have to state the specific grounds. No evidence has to state the elements for which there's no evidence. That's nothing new from the old rules. You had to do that. Of course, if you didn't, then you couldn't get summary judgment on that. Time to file. Traditional motion, no real change there. Anytime after you've appeared or answered, you can file a traditional motion for summary judgment. No evidence still has the same adequate time for discovery. So I think there will continue to be fights on that. And there's plenty of case law out there as to what constitutes an adequate time for discovery. One thing that will change, we'll talk about in a minute, is how you deal with that. And I wonder how much it works to change in the law. And then when it's filed, the clerk has to call the motion to the court's attention. But whatever that means, that's a question for the clerks and the judges. But the court has to promptly set the motion for submission or a hearing according to this rule. And so that is one of the new big changes, is the filing of the motion itself is going to trigger it to be set for hearing, not anything you do. So you can no longer just file your motion and let it sit there for whatever reason, if you're doing it for kind of a, you know, in advance of mediation, or you just want to get it on file. Or so I think probably what we're going to start seeing in docket control orders from courts is there's going to be maybe an earlier deadline for dispositive motions than previously, because you can't file this 21 days out from trial anymore, probably. I have to think that the way that the deadlines work in here, it's going to have to be further back. So I bet you're going to start seeing those dispositive motion deadlines move back, maybe considerably even.
I would think so. I mean, now that we've got a statutory time for ruling, you know, I think that would impact what trial courts are willing to do in terms of even entertaining summary judgment motions too close to trial. Travis County, as a practical matter, the courts pretty much won't hear a dispositive motion, you know, within a month of trial. So it wouldn't surprise me at all. One of the things that is pointed out in the Advocate article is that we're likely to see some updates and amendments to local rules, in addition to courts dealing with this through scheduling orders. That would not surprise me at all. And I think that's probably a good move, because it would be helpful if the courts in a specific region get together and decide how they want to handle this, to let practitioners know. And the local rule would be a good way to do it generally. And then, of course, docket control orders. I would suspect that summary judgment issues now will not be something that a trial judge will just automatically bless whatever the parties agree to. Now that we've got these new requirements, I think the courts may be a little more active and involved in what they include in scheduling orders or docket control orders when it comes to summary judgment. It is interesting that the clerk has to bring the motion to the court's attention. That's the way it should be. And then, you know, the court's got to set it for submission. There was some question, one of the things that was asked in the Advocate article is, you know, would the Supreme Court, that was something that was suggested, is that there would be new provisions, you know, talking about what the clerks need to do. The other thing that was suggested was that the court might also impose some duties on the parties to come back to the court and help the court to comply with the statutory deadlines. That really doesn't happen in these rules, in this new rule. It's basically the responsibility for staying on track is left with the court and with assistance from the clerk. Now, is it a good idea? This is kind of getting into the practice tip area, but is it a good idea to stay informed or to keep the court informed about what deadlines are? Why, certainly while this transition is going on, absolutely. And we can talk about that some more later if we have time. But, you know, bottom line, it's always a good idea to communicate with the court coordinator about deadlines coming up. But one thing that's probably worth mentioning even before we dive deeper into the rule is, you know, we've had statutes and rules, statutes primarily, I'm thinking about the TCPA, where there have been deadlines for ruling. And it's procedurally kind of similar because it's a potentially dispositive motion. There's a roadmap. There's something of a template for this. What we haven't seen before is these reporting requirements tied directly to data being fed, as you pointed out, Jody, to OCA, which is going to be provided quarterly to, you know, the highest echelons of our state government. And what happens with that when that data is reported, I don't know. That's going to be interesting to watch. That's beyond the full scope of our conversation today. But as we say all too often, it's an interesting time. It's always an interesting time when the ledge has come out of session, trying to figure out what the changes are going to look like. But that is a change that we'll all need to kind of keep an eye on, I think. So back to the response. So this is where the timing gets really interesting, because the rule provides, subsection D, that except by leave of court, the non-movement must file a response within 21 days after the motion is filed. This is a huge change from the old rule. I've indicated before, you know, you'd file a motion and the time for filing a response wasn't triggered at all until a hearing was set or a submission date was set. And then you knew under the old rule that you had to get your response in 7 days at least before the submission or hearing date. So you were able to set a firm deadline for yourself, but it wasn't triggered. You knew when your deadline was, but it wouldn't be triggered until that magical event of submission or a hearing date. This change is going to require non-movements to be far more proactive in getting their responses done and ready than they were before. One thing I'll note just in that part of it, the time to file, we'll talk about the contents in a second. It does not provide for a different deadline by agreement of the parties, which was the first thing that jumped out at me there, was how much of this can be modified by agreement of the parties. You know, typically, if you're busy, you're in trial, or you've got a couple of big briefs going on, and the idea of, I doubt you're going to know when the moving party is going to file their motion, and then boom, you got a 21-day deadline triggered that has to fit within all your other deadlines as a trial lawyer or the appellate lawyer working with trial lawyers. So that is a really short time frame.
It is, and I can see a couple of issues. The first one is it gives people who move for summary judgment kind of a hammer to use, sometimes perhaps improperly, because you could file a motion, make your opponent work like crazy, spend a lot of time, effort, and energy, and then you could just withdraw the motion. And there's nothing to stop you from doing that. I don't know if maybe you're trying to get them to marshal evidence or whatever it is, but you have to file your motion and ask for a hearing. And that's really it, is the only thing that starts the clock running for the other side. The second part of that is to get leave of court to extend or change your deadline. Practically, I think there are counties where that's just going to be impossible. Within 21 days of getting the response and getting a hearing to get leave of court to change your... So you're still going to have to be working in the background and may or may not be able to get it heard by the court in time.
Yeah, it does seem like the movement is really in the driver's seat on this. Yeah, I like your description. I don't like the impact of it, but I think your description is accurate, that this has the potential to really be a hammer. And yeah, the idea of getting leave of court, it does seem to be a gap in the rule where, you know, if your only option for extending that is leave of court, you can't do it by agreement of the parties. Now, would the movement agree, especially one that's motivated for the reasons that you just went through? Maybe not. But it seems like things are going to get scrunched up in there on that 21-day deadline. And you're right. I think maybe you're a movement who could have done a better job with discovery, and your trial date is, you know, lingering on the horizon, or your discovery date's about to pass, and you want a free look at what the evidence is going to be on your opposing party's motion, then file a no evidence motion. Not saying that's the best thing to do, but under the rules it's currently presented, it does seem like that's an option that the rule could be used for. Okay, contents. You know, the rule has always been that you had to bring objections within the time for responding to an MSJ. I do find it interesting that here under subsection D2, contents, it does say that the response has to include not only evidence in support of the response, but also objections to the evidence supporting the motion. So does that mean that you can't file objections separately now? That would seem to be an overly technical interpretation.
I think that's probably right. Certainly our Supreme Court has not embraced those types of readings of the rules, but I take your point.
I don't think that's really what is meant, but I also find it interesting that there's not a parallel provision stating that the motion must include any evidence. Now, obviously, you won't have objections at that point, but you know, traditional motion, it's sort of maybe it's just an understood implied thing in the rule that if you're going to file a traditional motion for summary judgment, you can file it on legal grounds where they don't necessarily involve evidence. You can file it on the pleadings, and that wouldn't involve evidence. But you know, obviously, if you're relying on evidence, I think you're going to have to include that with your motion, or are you? Because the rule doesn't say that.
The rule doesn't say you have to, but I think as a practical matter, you do.
And how does that overlay with the changes in timing? Going back to the idea of kind of sandbagging your opponent, can you file an MSJ and then submit your evidence only after you get a hearing set?
It doesn't say. The old rule had a very specific deadline for your evidence before the hearing, and this one doesn't necessarily.
So maybe something else for the committee to consider when they're looking at revisions to this rule. But that was just something that struck me. So this third part of subsection D on the response talks about when evidence is unavailable. I think that's really getting into the no evidence component, where you've seen folks file motions for continuance, you know, saying there's not an adequate time for discovery that's passed and so forth. This doesn't seem to be anything too earth-shattering. What it says basically is if you're the non-movement and you need more time to get more evidence, then you've got to file an affidavit or a declaration telling the court why. And then the court can extend the time to file a response or deny the motion without prejudice to permit additional discovery. That seems reasonable to me.
I think it's interesting. The only thing that I think is different is now that is part of your response, whereas before you might be able to file a motion to continue the summary judgment and get it heard and submitted before you actually had to file a response. And now you have to do the response, and this is part of it, which seems to be putting a lot of eggs in one basket. But, you know, I don't know. You have to put all your cards out there and hope for the best, I guess, rather than maybe knowing that you don't have to do a response. So a reply is permissive, which I guess is kind of has always been the case. It has to be filed within 7 days after the response, which is a pretty quick turnaround. And, you know, before there was no real deadline in the rule for a reply. You could do one if you had time. And I guess you really only had 7 days because typically the response was going to come at the earliest 7 days before the hearing. But now you have a hard deadline and it's keyed off of when the response is filed, regardless of when the hearing is. It can't raise any new or independent summary judgment grounds unless there's an amended pleading. But one thing that it doesn't say, and one thing that is not clear from these rules that you mentioned in the context of the initial motion, is the old rule, you couldn't file any new evidence after 21 days if you were the movant. This doesn't say you can or can't, but it just doesn't say. So arguably, you can't raise a new or independent ground. That does not, to me, in its words, foreclose you filing new evidence in response or in reply to a response.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's not something that you could have done under the old rule because of the hard 21-day notice period. You had to have it all in. The non-movement had to have that 21 days notice of the hearing at a minimum. And you couldn't go changing the game in the middle. So yet, not only do we have now expressly stated in the rule about when you've got to file a reply, it is different than previous practice, though, because, yeah, you're right that you only had 7 days to do it as a practical matter if the response was filed 7 days before the hearing, which would have been timely. I guess occasionally you would see responses filed sooner, but strategically, it was, in my experience, pretty rare.
Yeah, most of the time it's 7 days before.
That's right. But I wonder if part of the reason for this is common, but maybe not the best practice of dropping a reply on the court like the morning of the hearing.
That's how I read all of these deadlines, is the idea might be to give the court more time to digest since it's on a clock to rule more quickly.
Yeah.
You know, if you kind of back out from, you've got to have a hearing within 60 days, if you have to file within 21 days after it's set, and then 7 days after that, or 21 days after it's filed, 7 days after that, you're at about 30 days right there. Then within 30 days, the court has to hear it. I guess the idea is to give the court as much time as possible to kind of prepare and put it together, which I understand and sympathize with, particularly if it's going to have to make a ruling.
It's not a change in the law, this part of the court has added about contents. I mean, the rule generally, the law has been that the motion and the response, but this is a reply, so we're really talking about the motion, stand or fall within their own four corners. And so it is interesting that it does codify what you can do when the opposing party has amended the pleading. And there's a whole body of case law in that do you have to basically redo the whole motion just because the opposing side decided to amend their pleading to potentially meet some issue that you've raised in your MSJ? This expressly allows the moving party in a reply to address the amended pleading, which I think is in practice how it was done before because of the law that developed. It's not a new ground necessarily. And my recollection of the law on that is if the ground you asserted in your motion covered the new pleading, then you were good. You could still get summary judgment, even if there was some tweak to the theories that maybe the non-movement made to try and avoid summary judgment or cast doubt on whether it should be granted. So I think in practice, this is consistent with how things have been done. The second part of the rule on the reply. Well, the next part is the provision on withdrawal, which was, I think, part of the statute. But the rule says in subpart F that any withdrawal of the motion must be filed and must identify the date the motion was filed. And, you know, strategically, withdrawals are going to be a thing for lots of reasons, potentially. But, you know, going back to what you were talking about earlier about, you know, filing an early motion and trying to get leverage, you know, early in a case, or filing a motion maybe, you know, shortly before mediation, and then case doesn't settle. And then what happens if you're really not ready to advance the motion? So the rule is made clear. There's a mechanism for filing a withdrawal. And it's actually a separate filing. You can't just not take action.
Cancel the hearing.
Right. So just thinking through this, I mean, what happens if you're going to get notice of your hearing and maybe you intended to withdraw the motion, but you just didn't? And remind me, are we going to be allowed to withdraw a motion anytime before the submission date?
It doesn't say, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think it does either. And I think that's the implication.
Yeah, I think so too.
I guess the practice pointer there is, you know, don't make the court go through the exercise of setting a hearing and getting and starting to prepare for a hearing and then at the last minute withdraw your motion. You know, if you know you're going to withdraw it, I think the better practice would be advise the court that you're going to withdraw it and then go ahead and get that on file. And I think the other part of this is you can always, you know, bring it again later. If you filed it prematurely and you're not really ready to proceed on it for whatever reason, you know, withdraw it before you run up against any of the time frames that the court needs to be mindful of. And when you've got your ducks in a row and you've got your evidence or whatever ground, you know, you want to proceed on, then you can always re-bring it. That's the way that I read the rule.
I think that's right. The next portion is the hearing deadlines and the ruling deadlines. And this is, again, one of the big changes that the statute actually brought about. So the first part of the rule is a hearing or submission date can't be within 35 days of the filing. So instead of the 21 days notice you might have gotten before, you now get at least 35, which makes sense when you build in the fact that you've got to have at least 28 days worth of time from the filing of the motion to be able to get all the replies in. But the court has to set the motion for hearing or submission within 60 days after filing, unless the court's docket has an issue, there's some kind of good cause shown, or if the movement agrees. So there's a little bit of leeway, but not a whole lot. It's kind of like the TCPA in that respect. You've got to have it 60 days, or maybe you can push it out to 90, but 90 appears to be the hard deadline on this.
Yeah, this is where it is sort of reminiscent of the TCPA. I remember when that all first came about, and for a couple of years after that, there was a lot of pearl clutching about what are we going to do about these deadlines? And it seems to have worked itself out over time. I suspect it'll be the same for this rule.
Yeah, I think so too. The court can reset it, but it has to be within the time frame. So within your 60 days or maybe your 90 days, the court does have the option to reset it. You've got to, by rule now, which is, I think most local rules cover this, but by rule 166, you have to submit a proposed order before the submission or hearing date, which makes sense. Can't have oral testimony at the hearing. That's nothing new. And the court has to record in its docket the date the motion was heard or submitted, which, again, practically, I don't think is much different. It's just something that's in the rule, whereas it wasn't before, which has to do with the reports.
Yeah, that was statutory. And right, I think that does get into the reporting aspect of it. Okay, well, standards. I look at this and I think, and maybe it's nice to have some of this recited in the rule. First part is grounds. This rule says that judgment won't be granted except on the grounds, traditional or no evidence grounds, is the way it refers to the rule internally by number. But the grounds stated are B2C, which is traditional motion, and B2D, which are no evidence motion. Not sure what other grounds you would bring summary judgment, but that's it. So I, again, fine to state this. I'm not sure it's necessary, but okay. And here we get into the standards that the trial courts must apply. I think this will make its way into the appellate opinions too, eventually, in an appellate review under the standard of review. But the traditional motion, the new provision in the rule says the court must grant their traditional motion if the movement shows, this is mirror image of 166AC as it exists today. And you have to grant it if the movement shows, except as to damages, there's no genuine issue as to any material fact, and the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the issues expressly set out in the motion. So we're really getting it drilled into our head that, you know, you can't go outside the motion and grant summary judgment on grounds outside the motion. And here's the standard that I think has been followed for as long as there's been summary judgment in Texas. But the recitation on the standard for no evidence is the same as we read. And I think it's actually carries over almost verbatim, certainly the same concept. Soon to be former rule 166AI, which is the court must grant the no evidence motion unless the responding party produces summary judgment evidence raising a genuine issue of material fact.
I think that's right. The only thing I note here that's slightly different, and again, I think this is probably an unintended change, is in the traditional motion standard where it says, if you show that except as to damages, there's no genuine issue of material fact. The old rule said as to the amount of damages, they took out amount. And this almost, I don't think they mean you can't move for summary judgment on damages, but arguably that's how this rule now reads when you take out the word amount rather than just damages more generally.
Yeah, I can't really think of any other potential consequence to that.
Well, there are grounds to move for summary judgment on damages that are not the amount. It could be the wrong measure. It could be, you know, a lot of different things. But again, I doubt that that was an intended change, but it could be read that way. So I'll make sure to put that in my email.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sure that in part, and knowing that there's not an intention to change the law substantively, you know, maybe it was just a matter of somebody thought that amount of didn't add anything substantively, but I see your point. I think amount of did add something to the old rule. So I'll be curious to see how that turns out if comment period's over.
Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step. From review to filing, Counsel Press has your back. Visit counselpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal.
If we're done with standards, then the next provision has to do with the ruling, and it encompasses the rule. It says the court has to sign a written ruling on the motion. It says it has to file it with the clerk, which that's good. We've talked over a period of time about what happens when things aren't filed and notified. And this does say that the court has to provide the ruling to the parties within 90 days after the hearing or written submission date. We've got now some fail safes. My take on this is the key part of it is providing the ruling to the parties. And also, obviously, within the 90 days as the statute requires. But, you know, before there wasn't a provision requiring the court to actually provide the ruling to the parties. We've now got some fail safes built into our e-filing system through Research Texas, where everyone should be getting notices of all court orders now. And I'm not sure how much we've ever talked about this, but you may have noticed that you're getting redundant emails from not only you're getting your e-file e-service emails, but you're also getting emails from Research Texas that are case notices. And that was one of the things that was intended to help with was situations where the courts weren't providing their judgments or orders to parties. There was substantive rights being lost as a result of delay. You had some actions you could take, you know, 306A, you know, motions out of time. But the idea is this is not really what this rule change is completely about. I think it's designed really to meet the statutory deadline. But putting in that language there about providing the ruling to the parties within the 90 days, I do like to see that. I've always been uneasy about parties not being notified of court actions. I'm glad to see that, you know, between this and the way that we've got our e-filing system and Research Texas set up now, you know, you got to look at your email, but you're going to get notice of court orders.
The next one is kind of an interesting change that does not really have a counterpoint in the old rule, and it is the use of discovery not otherwise on file. So discovery that is not on file, which I assume to mean in the court's file, and I don't know if that means just filed someplace else or if it means certificates of written discovery or what, but you can use it as your summary judgment evidence, which is nothing new, but there have to be copies of the material or appendices containing the evidence, or a notice containing specific references to the discovery, or specific references to other instruments that are filed with a statement of intent to use the specific discovery as summary judgment evidence, either at the time of the motion, if you're using it to support your motion, or at the time the response is filed, if it's going to be used to oppose it. So this is an interesting change, and I'm not sure I completely understand how it's going to work, because I would think as a practical matter, if it's discovery that's not on file and you're the movement or the respondent, you would have to file it with the court, because otherwise, how would the court be able to see the evidence to evaluate whether or not there's genuine issues of material fact? So this was an interesting change that I don't know that I've fully absorbed yet.
I don't think I have. This made me think of recitations in the summary judgment motions where you are referring to other materials that are on file, not necessarily attached to your motion or to your response, I think. But this is, I think you're correct that this is something different. And I think I agree that, well, if it's not otherwise on file, you need to get it on file. And why you would do it, I'm not sure I really understand the purpose of this, because you have to file it with a statement of intent, as you pointed out. Why wouldn't you just attach it to your motion and incorporate it as an exhibit? The finer points of that, I think, are not registering with me just yet.
Me neither, but just be aware that that exists.
Yeah, it does. The subsection, the subparts of that rule do clarify. Maybe it is kind of an appendix idea, because if you turn the page, that was at the bottom of page 5. At the top of page 6 of the order, it does clarify that these materials have to be presented at the time the motion is filed, if it's used to support summary judgment, or at the time the response is filed. So I think that avoids any implication that you could file your motion. Maybe this answers my question from a little while ago. Could you file your motion and just not ever file your evidence until sometime later? Well, this seems like that clears it up.
A little bit, but this is only limited to discovery, not on file, which, you know, you use plenty of other things to support your summary judgment motion that may or may not be discovery. I don't know. It's just, it's one that I don't know that I fully understand yet, but I guess we'll figure it out.
The subpart K, all requested relief not granted, it's something that's brought over. It was in another form, and it was the old Rule 166AE, case not fully adjudicated on motion. And I think the intent is to basically bring forward the concept that was in the old rule, although it does delete one of my favorite phrases in Rule 166A, which was that the court could interrogate counsel.
They should leave that in.
You know, that's an old vestige of, I don't know, I haven't been interrogated by the court too many times in my career, but I think that served a good purpose. It was basically trying to get at, all right, here's what I am going to give you on summary judgment, and let's talk about what's left. And I think that that's the same intent being carried forward here in this new version, which basically just says, if the court doesn't grant all the relief that the motion requests, then the court may ascertain what material fact issues exist and then identify those issues or identify the facts that are established as a matter of law and then figure out what else needs to be addressed. So I think that it works as a practical matter the same as in the old rule. And maybe we haven't said this explicitly, but you know, one thing that this rewrite does accomplish is there's a few archaic phrases in the old 166A. There's a few therewiths and that sort of thing that we don't see in this rewrite. And so I think the court, you know, probably could still interrogate counsel in its discretion.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've been interrogated in all kinds of proceedings in court that are not summary judgment. And just because the rule doesn't specifically say it doesn't mean it can't happen.
That's right. That's right. So I think in part what this means is you can still have, the court may grant your relief in part, and there may be parts left over that still have to be resolved. But this is saying that the court may issue an order specifying facts established as a matter of law and direct other appropriate proceedings. So you'll know what's left of your case that needs to be tried or otherwise resolved at the end of this summary judgment proceeding.
I think that's right. Form of affidavit looks to me to be just effectively a similar kind of modern rewrite of 166AF. There's not really much different there. They delete the sentence that says defect in the form of affidavit or attachments won't be ground for reversal unless specifically pointed out by objection. I can't imagine that the omission changes that rule at all. I think there's a pretty good body of case law from the Supreme Court that says defects in substance don't have to be objected to, but defects in form do. So I don't think the fact that the rule says it or doesn't is likely to change that.
I agree with that. And the court was probably wise to not try and get into what is a substantive defect or a form defect within the body of the rule. The case law is very well established on that too. Although it's not always as black and white as you would think.
Well, that's true, but
yeah. Affidavit, the last part of the new rule is subpart M, and it has to do with affidavits or declarations submitted in bad faith. I think substantively, this is the same as in the old rule. It's subpart H under the old rule. It's basically don't do it. And if you do, You can be held responsible for the other side's expenses, including attorney's fees, and possibly could be held in contempt or subject to other sanction. So that is hopefully no one listening to our show. This is something we even need to have a lecture on. You know, it just carries forward the, I think, previous practice, which is, I think, a good rule. You shouldn't be able to contradict your clear deposition testimony by submitting an affidavit that goes directly against what you said in sworn testimony.
Although I do think that that is a little bit, I mean, that is a sham affidavit, which I'm not sure is the same thing as a bad faith affidavit. It may be so bad that it's bad faith, but.
Oh, no, you're right. That is true. They could be the same, but it isn't necessarily. Yeah, it isn't necessarily the same. The court does suggest what bad faith is. Bad faith could be solely for delay, but that's, you know, maybe something other than, because it's separately set out in the rule, bad faith can be other things. Increasing costs, taking, you know, frivolous positions, whatever they may be. There is a distinction between a sham affidavit and a bad faith affidavit. Sham affidavit could be bad faith, but bad faith wouldn't necessarily be sham.
No, definitely.
All right. The comments from the previous revisions, 1990 and 1997, remain in the rule. Those are there. The first couple are there, I think, mostly for, they're sort of historical artifacts above everything else because of the nature of the rewrite. And the only comment to the 2026 change is it's rewritten to implement government code section 23.303 and to modernize the rule, which is good. And then it recites that there's no intent to substantively change the law. We're running a little bit long, but what are the takeaways beyond just having gone through the new rule structure that we come away with from this conversation today, or just the fact that we're now seeing this change?
I think to me, the takeaway, the big one is make sure you're on top of summary judgments when you get one, particularly if you're the respondent. You know, in the old days, okay, you got a summary judgment motion, but until you get the notice of hearing, it is what it is. But now, your deadline starts to run, I think, even if it's not set for hearing, it's just from the date that it's filed. And so I think it's important to start calendaring your deadlines the minute you get it. And I'm not sure that we had to under the old rules, you know, so make it file summary judgment and maybe months and months before it even gets set for a hearing, or never, frankly. So I think stay on top of that. And I think about what you would move for summary judgment on, or what you anticipate the other side to move for summary judgment on early, so you can kind of put your stuff together and be in a position to respond as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think the changes do advise toward using summary judgment motions judiciously. Just, I don't think you want to get into a situation where you just, it's common practice for you to withdraw your motions. I think both of us would probably say, if you've got grounds to bring it, bring it. But keep in mind that you are starting a clock for the trial court, that you don't want to reset the clock too many times, or maybe the court, you know, gets tired of you filing and withdrawing summary judgment motions. But to me, that's the biggest overall takeaway to all this is, you know, for the first time, we've got our trial judges on the clock when it comes to summary judgment motions. And as we've said, you know, we've got some experience with this under the TCPA. All the trial judges, you know, they've coped with that and it's been fine. But what we haven't had are the reporting requirements that come along with this legislation. So that's going to be something that, you know, time will tell what the result of that is. But I think you have to be strategic with your summary judgment filings. What strategy turns out to be legitimate versus not legitimate, as we pointed out here today, there are some uses of it. Might not be the intended use.
That's right.
But there's always going to be someone who's going to test the limits. And that's how the law evolves. So we're making no endorsement of any particular strategy.
we're here to just point out stuff we see.
That's right. And I'm having fun with some of the rule change stuff that we've been able to do lately. I think it gives us a reason to get together and just talk through stuff. And hopefully people find what we have to say and the questions that we ask helpful. If you've got other things that you'd like to see us talk about, though, you know, let us know. Reach out to one of us and we'll consider that for a future episode. Anything before we sign off today, Jody?
I don't think so. February 28th is the deadline for comments, but I'd say sooner is better than later. So get them in if you have them.
Yeah, the ledge did say this was not really optional for the Supreme Court. Even though the order says the court expects the amendments to take effect on March 1, I believe the statute says the court will adopt new rules or a new rule by March 1. So I don't think that date's going to change.
There will be a rule. It may not be exactly this, but it's going to be something similar, I think.
So yeah, get those comments in and yeah, definitely let your voice be heard, because as we pointed out here before, I know the court does consider those comments. Those are discussed actively in the Supreme Court Advisory Committee and brought to the court's attention. As we've pointed out here today, I think there are a few things that could be revisited and clarified. So get those comments in.
All right. Well, with that, I think that's it for this episode, and we'll see you next time.
That's right. Hope everyone has a great start to 2026, and we'll be seeing you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.